From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. We all know airport security since 9/11, and not many of us love it. The lines, the shoes off, the belt off, often the mess. Now, it's changing again. Last week, the TSA announced that from April 25th, small pocket knives and more will be allowed back on planes as carry-on. But the much bigger deal is a new strategy unfolding to focus not on risky objects, but on risky people. This you want to pay attention to. This could be a big deal. Up next, On Point, the TSA's new strategy on airline security. You can join the conversation. Have you heard the backlash to the knives on the plane change? Where do you stand on that? And how much personal information would you be prepared to hand over to skip the security line? Do you trust the TSA to figure out what kind of person you are? What kind of risk? We will talk in this hour with a former national head of the TSA who says it's time for a change, with a privacy advocate with big concerns about where we're headed, with a representative for flight attendants who's not so crazy about the knife change. Lots of pushback on that. Joining me first today from New York is Susan Stellan. She covers technology, business, and travel for the New York Times. Wrote a piece this week about the TSA's new strategy. The link is up at our website, onpointradio.org. Susan Stellan, thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks, Tom.
Susan, if you would be good enough first, tell us, why is the TSA planning, I mean, unless this backlash derails it, why do they want to bring pocket knives, golf clubs, pool cues, lacrosse sticks, skiing poles, allow all that back into the cabin as carry-on? Why?
Well, there are actually a few motivations. One is it is part of this strategy of moving toward trying to focus on things that are likely to cause greater risk or harm to an aircraft. So one line of thinking is that looking for small Swiss Army knives distracts screeners from looking for explosives or things that could cause what they call catastrophic damage to an aircraft. A second motivation is to more closely align what we're doing in the U.S. with what happens when people travel all around the world. So in some countries and some regions, you can take these things on the plane, and they're trying to do what some passengers have asked for, which is have sort of more consistent standards and rules.
Standardized, I mean, you look back to 9/11, and it was box cutters or some kind of small blade. The story, as we understand it at this point, is that was used to do a lot of damage and take over those planes. Isn't that still a potential threat here? Wouldn't they be worried about that?
Well, one big difference is that they now have what's called hardened cockpits. So someone, even if they did have a sharp object, wouldn't be able to enter the cockpit because those doors have been, you know, blocked now. So the thinking is, you know, these are small knives that, you know, people carry, they forget about, probably a lot of them get through security anyway. You know, why don't we just focus on things that could cause more trouble?
So don't even try 2.5 or 3/4 inch long blade, not more than 1/2 inch wide, so it's not even a big pocket knife. And yet, if somebody really wanted to do damage here, you know, we've got listeners saying online, it doesn't take much to, forgive me, but it doesn't take much to slit a throat. I mean, even if they can't get through the door, you can start tolling up pretty big damage outside the cockpit.
Well, yeah, and there's two contexts, too. Is this a rule that's trying to prevent terrorism or someone who wants to bring down an aircraft, or is it a rule that generally increases safety in the plane to not have knives and sharp objects, you know, in a cabin where people are cramped? And, you know, I think that, you know, I won't speak for the flight attendants or flight crew, but it's not just about trying to keep people from taking over an aircraft, but, you know, when we're all in an environment where every seat is full and people are, you know, fighting over overhead space, then, you know, do you want to add sharp objects to the mix?
We're going to look a lot more at that, but I also want to look at this bigger strategy change, because it's really interesting here, where they're moving to control not risky objects as much as risky people, to, they call it the passenger differentiation. What's on the drawing board here, Susan?
Well, a lot of this is already happening in terms of when you travel across border, and in particular, the Department of Homeland Security gets a lot of this data. You know, some people know it as what they enter when they book a ticket through Secure Flight and giving your name and details of your birth date and things like that. And then, you know, Customs and Border Protection also collects data when you pass in and out of the country. You know, sometimes you're questioned, what was the purpose of your trip? That stuff all goes in a file. The idea now is to move some of that information also into the screening process domestically at checkpoints. So, you know, people complain about the lines, you know, and think, I'm not a threat. Why are they spending all this time looking at me? But in order to make these distinctions between who should we be screening more carefully and who should we let pass through, maybe without taking off their shoes, they have to know something about you. And at the heart of that is this idea of personal data and how much data they're going to collect. And, you know, aside from the privacy issue, the other issue, which was what I was trying to focus on in my article, was how good is this data and how much does it predict your risk to the aviation security? And, you know, I think that's the big question.
I mean, not to mention, you look at those huge, huge crowds going through security at the airports onto all those flights. I mean, the amount and depth of personal data they'd have to have on each person to make any kind of assessment. I mean, even if they had very deep data, how are they really going to know who's a risk and who's not? And how are we as flying public going to know who's going to be left in the long line and who's going to be swanning right through?
Well, and one of the factors they're looking at is sort of, do you have any kind of criminal record? And that's actually a really broad topic, because when people apply for one of the trusted traveler programs that exists now called Global Entry, one of the questions is, have you ever been arrested? Well, you might say no, because you forget that time when, you know, you were
back in high school trespassing.
Right. And as it turns out, about 1 in 4 American adults has some kind of criminal record. So does that make 25% of the adult traveling public not trusted for purposes of screening people for terrorism? You know, it starts opening a lot of interesting issues as you're trying to drill down into how do you make these decisions, and also are they being made by databases and algorithms as opposed to
some people? Kind of wisdom. Not to mention, I mean, what portion of people even who have an arrest record are really a terrorist threat on an airplane? It must be minute. And think of all those who could be a threat with no arrest record whatsoever.
Well, and part of the issue is that this global entry process started as something that was used when you're entering the country. So in that case, it's not just looking for terrorism, but are you carrying contraband, or, you know, do you have any kind of record that might indicate, you know, maybe you got arrested for marijuana possession or something like that? And that might be a legitimate thing to consider as far as letting you enter the country without speaking to an agent or with less screening.
Maybe, but I wondered about, I came into the country recently and saw an enormous line of people waiting to go through customs and immigration, and then an almost empty, wide, huge, open path for this thing called global entry, where I guess, what do? You pay something, you get a background check, and then you can just essentially, you know, whisk your passport through a scanner and waltz right in.
Well, yeah, you do have to give up your fingerprints when you apply for the program. So then if you're accepted, you also run your fingerprints on this machine to prove that it's you that is coming through. But, yeah, it is much quicker, and the lines can be, you know, 2 hours at peak times at some airports to re-enter the country.
If you don't have the global entry thing, this seems like a lot of leverage from the government at a point where people are sensitive to get people to cough up a whole lot of personal exposure here. I mean, if you don't sort of, you know, open the robe and show them everything, you can go over there and stand in line for an hour or two or more. If you let them dip into all of your personal data, maybe you can waltz right in. But should we really have to do that? Is this really better than letting them go through my bag and pull out the knife?
Well, another avenue that the TSA is looking into is how to merge some of this data with what's available from third-party commercial data providers. So that adds another wrinkle. Now, that's in the early stage. They put out a proposal, you know, soliciting ideas from these companies. But, you know, start thinking about what's available when, you know, you start looking at your purchase history and all the stuff that data brokers have, and you try to merge that into some kind of trusted traveler system. Then it starts getting to be just a voluminous amount of information, and people really don't know what's being used and what's already being collected about them.
What about when I travel overseas? If I go to China, is the U.S. government going to just give them a big data dump on me?
Well, that was actually an issue that came up at this conference on aviation security that took place in New York last week, where, you know, there were representatives from around the world and, you know, European attitudes toward privacy tend to be much more stringent than they are in the U.S., but that was an issue that was brought up that, you know, sometimes once the U.S. starts doing something, you know, like fingerprinting, other countries do it too. So if we're insisting on having all this data about travelers, then what's going to happen when other countries say, all right, well, we want the same level of data, and how would that be used?
You quote the German commissioner on this saying, wait a minute, this is too invasive. In Germany, we don't want to require people to cough all this up. We're not even sure it'll be effective.
Yeah, I mean, that was sort of on some of these panels, but it was an interesting issue and one that I think is going to get more attention as more people become aware of what kind of proposals are on the table.
Susan, we're going to hear some of the pushback here, but just on the knives and hockey sticks and all the rest, or lacrosse sticks, there's been a lot of pushback from congresspeople and some flight attendants. We'll hear from one in just a moment. Is that going through? Is the TSA determined to put knives back on the plane, or might that be squashed?
You know, I've been reading the same coverage as everybody else. I mean, there are a lot of voices saying this isn't a good idea. I know that it's been looked at and discussed in kind of some past hearings, but, you know, right now, at least the TSA is saying we're going ahead with it on April 25th, so we'll see.
Delta saying, please don't do it. The CEO there, United Airlines, we read, saying, please don't do it. Flight attendant saying, please don't let knives back on. Some pilots saying, okay. Susan Stellan has been reporting on all this and the big strategy change, which we're going to dig into for the New York Times, joined us today from New York. Thanks, Susan, for your time.
Thanks, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the TSA's new airline security strategy, moving from risky objects to risky people as their focus, and what that may mean for flyers, for you. Last week, the TSA is saying pocket knives, small ones, will be allowed back on planes. All kinds of reaction to that. What's it mean? Well, how do you feel about it? Does it make sense? Your shampoo bottle, no. Knives, yes. And what about this bigger shift to assessing not your stuff, but you? Is the federal government capable of assigning each of us a risk number? Really? We'll have a former head of the TSA with us in this hour. In just a second, the representative of an association of flight attendants. We'll have a privacy advocate here. Lots of reaction to the news on knives coming back onto planes. ABC News interviewed passengers in Washington on Friday. Here's air traveler Tracy Leinart, who says, fine, great, let's have the knives.
I use it for personal things, to cut string or something that I need sort of in everyday life. So, yeah, I'm glad it's back in and put it in my pocket.
Can put it back in his pocket, says Tracy. A lot of politicians not so sure. Yesterday, Ed Markey, Democratic congressman out of Massachusetts, held a news conference at the Logan Airport in Boston, said the TSA is making a mistake with a new policy on knives.
On 9/11, we learned that in the confines of an airline cabin, even a small knife can lead to devastating consequences.
And here's New York's Democratic Senator Chuck Schumer saying, turn around this decision.
Does anyone think this, which you're not allowed to bring on a plane, a bottle of shampoo, is more dangerous than this, a sharp and deadly knife? So what the heck is the TSA doing?
And New York's Republican Congressman Peter King talking with Andrea Mitchell on MSNBC about the TSA head John Pistol's decision to allow the knives back.
As far as the pocket knives, when that was first rolled out, I had assumed that John Pistol had spoken with the air marshals and the flight attendants, because there is some rationale to what he was trying to do in that by taking things like pocket knives off the table, if you will, they could focus more on other devices or instruments that we may feel are more lethal, without getting into any type of specifics. But the fact that he didn't, and there is such resistance now from the law enforcement community, I really think that he should go back and look at that, relook at it before it's implemented.
New York Republican Congressman Peter King, former chairman of the House Committee on Homeland Security, he mentioned pushback from airline attendants. Let's talk with a representative of those right now from Washington. Sarah Nelson is with us, vice president of the Association of Flight Attendants. Flight attendant for United for 17 years. Her group represents 90,000 attendants around the country. They've launched a national opposition campaign, starting with a petition to the White House with something like 28,000 signatures saying, please no knives on planes. Sarah Nelson, welcome. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much, Tom.
Why are you against it?
Well, we're against it because I'm a flight attendant who works in the cabin, and my job is to act as a first responder in the last line of defense. And we carry that responsibility with us to work every single day as we usher millions of passengers to their place safely. And these passengers expect to be protected. So it's not just about landing the plane safely. It's about making sure that everyone in the cabin is alive when that plane lands. And we see disturbances on board our aircraft every single day. And we have to de-escalate those issues. Our airplanes are fuller than ever. And sometimes we even have to ask the passengers and direct the passengers to help us contain a problem. You introduce a deadly weapon into that scenario, and it simply makes all of us less safe.
Yeah, but I mean, I carried pocket knives on planes for many years before 9/11. I think I've had three or four taken away just forgetting in the years since. I mean, you've been an attendant for a long time, Sarah. You know that people had these on planes for years, and it wasn't exactly mayhem up there.
Well, a lot has changed since September 11th, and I also want to note that before the morning of September 11th, the threat of using commercial aircraft as a weapon was unknown, and at great cost, we do know better today. The TSA was created because blades were on the airplanes, and they were used to cause that deadly attack on U.S. soil. So there's just no excuse for reversal on this policy. I mean, I want to be really clear that we absolutely support risk-based security screening, but it makes no sense to introduce a risk into that system. Multi-layered security, including prohibition of these items that could pose a threat, ensures that U.S. aviation is the safest in the world. And the ban on dangerous objects is an integral layer of that aviation security.
You know, you were saying earlier that it's not just about landing the plane safely, it's about safety in the sky as well. Are you sure the TSA agrees with you on that? I think I've seen TSA representatives saying, look, we can't protect against every little mishap in the sky. Our job is to protect against the big things, 9/11 style things, turning planes into missiles. Beyond that, we can't be responsible for everything.
Well, then they're missing a huge part of the equation, because this is also about making sure that the passengers that we carry and the crew members who are on those aircraft are safe too. And former TSA Administrator Kip Hawley has stated that he thinks we should go ahead and have battle axes and machetes too on board. And, you know, maybe he should be put on the no-fly list for making those comments from our perspective. But, you know, his point is that even with those weapons, you won't be able to gain access to the cockpit and take down a plane like on 9/11.
Because they have reinforced doors now.
That's right. So their strategy seems to be to sacrifice the cabin in favor of keeping the cockpit safe. And flight attendants and passengers are left to fend for themselves in the cabin. So TSA's new policy and Kip Hawley's outrageous comments make it utterly clear that the policymakers are knowingly gambling with the lives of flight attendants and passengers because our safety is not their priority.
We're going to talk with Kip Hawley in just a moment. Do you think you're going to turn this around? TSA keeps coming out and saying, in spite of the pushback, no, we're going ahead with this. That's the way it goes. Knives on a plane.
I do think we're going to turn this around. Air marshals are with us. Pilots are with us. Yesterday, the security agents, the transportation security officers, through their union, American Federation of Government Employees, came out against this. We've got the airlines all on board. We all recognize the people who are on the front lines of safety and security in aviation understand that this is a bad idea. And you mentioned our petition, noknivesonplanes.com, to the White House. That is growing in popularity every single day.
Sarah Nelson, Vice President of the Association of Flight Attendants, joining us from Washington. Thank you very much for being with us, Ms. Nelson.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Kip Hawley is with us now, former head of the Transportation Security Administration from 05 to 09, author of Permanent Emergency Inside the TSA and the Fight for the Future of American Security, joins us from Salinas, California. Mr. Hawley, Kip Hawley, thanks very much for being here.
My pleasure, Tom.
Battle axes and machetes on planes, you say? Really?
Well, I'm not recommending that people bring them. I'm just saying that the point is that the size of the blade doesn't matter, that the real threat to take down a plane now, while at 9/11 it happened to be blades, and in the years since then we've slammed that door shut from a security point of view, and now the real vulnerability is in bombs. But I would like to say that, and I thought Sarah Nelson articulated it very well, there is a legitimate cabin safety concern. And on 9/11, the cabin safety concern was intertwined with the counterterrorism security problem. And Susan highlighted this in your earlier segment, and that for TSA, you have to ask the question, what justifies the federal government taking your property? And for TSA, it's if something poses a significant risk to be used in a successful terror attack, and no longer that's the case with blades.
So are you saying the TSA is not in the cabin safety business? That's up to the flight attendants and the air marshals. You're just in the don't bring down the plane, don't bring down the World Trade Center.
No.
What then?
No. The FAA is in the cabin safety business. And the FAA, if they believe there's a cabin safety issue, can issue their regulations. They have all the legal authority in the world. If they view a cabin safety issue with people bringing on knives, just the way they do words with friends or smoking in the lavatories. Also, there's a program that I think Sarah Nelson and the flight attendant should go right after, which is the CEOs of the airlines are supporting them on this. But there is a free TSA program put on by the air marshals for self-defense of a flight crew. And they don't charge for it. But the airlines make the flight attendants pay their own way, do it on their own time.
But and either way, you're saying, Sarah, if you're worried, learn jujitsu or something.
Well, I'm saying that the TSA is really up against it in finding the small bomb parts that will destroy large numbers of aircraft at the same time.
Because it's such a challenge to do that, you mean?
It's very hard. Mm-hmm. And think of it from a cognitive perspective. Yep. If you're an officer, you're looking at a screen in a limited period of time.
All day long.
And you've got to find, you know, if you got the long list, it's harder to find everything. And we know that Al-Qaeda puts in distraction objects so that the officers will grab that and miss the bomb. And one thing that we know from covert testing is that, in fact, the officers fall victim to that.
I mean, it happened just last week. The guy went through, this was a TSA inspector, went through in Newark with an improvised, with an IED simulated in his trousers, got a pat down on everything, and they didn't find it.
Well, that's why they're doing these testing, because TSA legitimately is concerned about the risk of bombs coming on planes. There is no possibility of somebody hijacking a plane with a blade, whether it's a razor blade, a 2.6-inch knife, a 5-inch knife, and that's why I said battle axe. I mean, I still don't get how you can
assert that. I mean, you know, we did see it happen on 9/11. I know they've got reinforced doors now, but I mean, here's Arthur Frommer, famous traveler guy, Frommer's travel guides, and he's saying, you know, such knives drawn across the neck of a person can kill them just as effectively as a box cutter. How many bodies pile up outside the cabin before they open that door?
Well, first of all, your bare hands can kill somebody. You can kill somebody gruesomely with your necktie.
Yeah.
The idea of chasing around objects that can hurt people, I said to somebody, you get your key and you get an empty Coke can and you score it, twist it, and you've got a 12-inch razor blade.
Yeah, but there's matters of degree here. I mean, after April 25th, I could show up at the airport behind, I don't know, half a dozen guys, wonderful guys from Hell's Angels, carrying knives and pull cues and souvenir baseball bats and lacrosse sticks and golf clubs. Doesn't sound so great. And on we all go together, have a few whiskeys and rumble.
TSA is facing a real terrorist threat, and not the Hell's Angels. And this could happen to you at your school, at your grocery store. And so do you want to put federal air marshals in schools and federal air marshals in grocery stores? I mean, we have a violent society that is a real problem in America.
And you can't do everything. You're kind of saying if you want to find those bomb threats and the rest.
Well, I'll tell you what. I was administrator in 2006 when Al-Qaeda had a plot that we could not stop to blow up 19 jumbo jets and their flight crews and their passengers over the ocean.
And this is out of the Philippines, that one?
No. This is the liquid bomb plot.
Okay.
And that's why, and we were complete, our technology could not detect their bombs. So what Al-Qaeda did on 9/11 was go for a vulnerability at blades. We closed that. They then went for a shoe bomb vulnerability.
Yeah.
We closed that. They then invented a very, very sophisticated liquid explosive that we could not detect, and we've closed that. They went then next to the underwear bomb that they made poorly,
right?
And they're now working on a successor to that will work And take down a plane.
So you don't want to mess around with little pocket knives when all that's going on, you're saying?
That is exactly right. And if you're John Pistol, ahead of the TSA, mm-hmm. and you're responsible to the world, you will never sleep another night again in your life if something happens. And he has got a real problem with getting his officers totally focused on the toxins and the bomb
and everything
components.
Else. We're looking at the want to look at the bigger strategy here as well. Kip Hawley was head of the TSA. He's with us today from California. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Mr. Hawley, the big news strategy I'm trying to wrap my mind around, yeah. where already if you sort of show your stuff and apply and tell the government a lot, you can get this global entry status. I just saw last week where you can kind of whisk in. Instead of going through immigration, they've got your background data, and you can walk right through what was a very open line the night that I was standing in a long line to talk with a human being. So in the future, this is what we're looking at more of, the government getting more background information on people so they can decide who waltzes in and who stands in line?
Maybe. I think it's right after 9/11, it's the Holy Grail because – we all know that we're not terrorists, so why are we wasting time on us? And a bunch of contractors reverse engineered the hijackers from 9/11 and said, see, if we run our algorithm, we can separate out the terrorists.
You mean they would have known just by their passports that
that's
they were
what
a threat?
Well, that's what they said. But
yeah.
I frankly don't buy it. But let me just take exception to one thing that you were saying in your promotion, which is that they're going from not risky things to not, to risky people.
Yeah.
But it's really risk, not just things, not just people, because other dimensions of risk are below the line, out of public view. Vulnerability in the system.
Well, you may be right at some level, but I have to insist that I don't think I got that wrong at all. They're calling it the passenger differentiation concept. And here's Janet Napolitano. She's Secretary of Homeland Security. You're retired. And she says she's describing this shift as, I'm quoting her here, a risk-based approach that attempts to segregate out passengers for whom we have a lot of information and can evaluate their risk as low risk versus those we know little about or that are higher risk. That's passengers, Mr. Hawley.
Well, yes, but that's what she's saying. But what I'm telling you is...
she's the boss.
What I'm saying is that you have to add to the equation vulnerability of your system and the intelligence that you're getting to factor in risk. So you're not just looking out at the people coming at you. You're not just looking at what they're carrying. You're also factoring in the vulnerability that you have in your system.
Here's what I'm afraid of. In a year or two, unless I let you poke around in every little aspect of my life, just totally reveal myself in a way I've never been required to before, I'm going to have to wait for 2 hours with my family to fly to see grandma while, everybody who's open the kimono fabulously to the government, you just gets to waltz on.
Tom,
and this is incredible leverage,
Tom, I went through this in my time at TSA. There are so many people want to believe that there's a magic formula that will segregate the threats from the non-threats. And we wasted from 2001 until 2009 just doing the simple fact of matching watch lists on this wild goose chase to find who the good guys were through data.
And but they're making it the strategy now. You may think it won't work, but this is where they're going, isn't it? This isn't a hypothetical.
Well, I think once you hear from Mark here in a few minutes, you're going to hear that there's a lot of privacy issues that are legitimate, and there's a lot of efficacy issues that are legitimate, because Al-Qaeda has proven that they are able to recruit people who have no record that would show up in any kind of database.
Exactly.
Search.
Exactly.
And,
so pristine, sort of virgin flyers or whatever.
Clean skin. Absolutely.
Kip Hawley, please stand by. Former head of the TSA, not speaking for them formally today, and not necessarily saying exactly what they're saying, but we're very glad for your insights. Please stand by in California. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the TSA's new airline security strategy. They want to know a lot and what it may mean for flyers, what it may mean for you. Kip Hawley is with us from Salinas, California, former head of the TSA, author of Permanent Emergency. We're going to hear in just a moment from a big privacy advocate. People are thinking a lot about this. Pushback on the knives front. On Friday, Republican Senator John McCain of Arizona talked with Piers Morgan on CNN about the new knives policy. The senator was skeptical, but does think the TSA reforms do need to go further.
My beef with TSA, my friend, is that our security procedures have basically not changed in the last 12 years. They're still having to do invasive body searches. We still wait in long, long lines. Couldn't we have a fast lane? Couldn't we have develop a technology where we could all just walk through? In other words, I have not seen a single advance in technology in expediting people through airports since we put these procedures in place in 9/11. That's what I'd like to know about.
Yes, we'd love some magical, marvelous quick tunnel you could walk through and straight on the plane. That would be awesome, but what will it know? We're going to go to Mark Rotenberg in just a second here, but so many callers waiting such a long time. Let's get a couple. Dave in Omaha, Nebraska. Dave, thanks. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. I love you guys' show. I just wanted to make the point, and I'm sorry, I caught her late, so I did not catch her name, but she made the comment that that the cockpit is like the stronghold point, and that
yes.
Us as passengers and stewardesses are being given the short shrift on it, I guess. I carry a blade at all times for my job, for random things that I need to do during the day.
What's your job, Dave? What's your job?
I'm a sign installer.
Okay, that
and
figures.
I use my blade for cutting and prying and everything else. I use it for things that it's not even supposed to be used for. But as a knife owner and a person who's accustomed to having a blade, I would much prefer to as a passenger have a blade handy in case something went down. On 9/11, they took over those planes with box cutters, and the guys on United 93 attacked them with fire extinguishers in the beverage cart. I would much rather have my pocket knife with me in the eventuality that I need it. You know, at the risk of being the guy that brings the knife to the toxin or the bomb fight, I always feel better when I've got one on me. So.
Citizen Dave, I think I'd be happy to have you alongside me in the event of real trouble. On the other hand, there might be somebody else who I don't want with a blade. I don't know. But I take your point exactly. I appreciate your call from Omaha, Dave. Let me get one more here. Lexington, Kentucky. Jack, you're on the air, Jack.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I have a question. Well, one of my concerns is that if the security decides to focus on people versus focusing on weapons, what about racial profiling? Because wouldn't that open up doors for people, for them to say, well, this person's a minority and this minority always carries knives, or they carry knives more than this other minority does. So, I mean, we need to watch them more. I mean, wouldn't this open up doors for racial profiling?
Well, racial profiling or other kinds of profiling. I mean, in the end, what kind of profiling can really determine whether somebody has malicious intent or not? It's a big, good question, Jack. And let me pick it up right here, if I may, with Kip Holly, standby in California. I want to welcome Mark Rotenberg into the conversation. He's president and executive director of the Electronic Privacy Information Center, professor of information privacy law at Georgetown University. Mark Rotenberg, thanks very much for being here.
Sure.
So here we are. We're reading about a big strategy change that goes more toward information than just what you may be carrying. Knives on the plane, okay, but who are you? What do we know about you? And should we let you come on easily or put you through a lot of rigmarole or not let you on at all? What about this as a path for air travel security, Mark?
Well, I think to understand the significance of the TSA proposal, your listeners need to understand that under the current TSA approach, the focus is on determining the actual identity of the traveler. That's why you provide your name, your gender, your date of birth. The TSA wants to know that when there's a particular John Smith going through the line, which John Smith this is, and then they need to make a determination. Is this person on a watch list? Is this person on a no-fly list? And if that person is on a list, they make that binary decision, and they say, you know, you're not going to get on the plane, or we're going to look a little more closely.
Right.
That's the big change that happened post 9/11, because pre 9/11, the identity of the passenger was not a big concern. Now, obviously, it is.
So we're all familiar with that. What's coming? What's the next change?
And there's a little bit of randomness thrown in on top, by the way. I should add that as well. That's part of the security protocol. We're going to just pull a few people aside so that nothing's too predictable. And I think this is all understandable for our post 9/11 airport security procedures. What the TSA is proposing to do is a radical shift. They don't want to simply do that binary determination. They want to begin to look at a whole range of factors and try to assess, perhaps based on travel destination, based on whether the ticket was purchased with cash, possibly based on nationality, whether someone should be subject to more scrutiny. And I think this particular approach raises very significant legal issues. I think it raises constitutional issues, as your last caller asked. You know, what if you introduce race into the mix? Should that be a basis, for example, for you know, giving someone more invasive screening? I think the answer is obviously no. But the problem with the TSA's approach is that they're so secretive about all this. They won't tell the public or even Congress what the criteria are that they're using to make these determinations, what they propose to use.
It's a lot of data collection that they appear to be looking at here, and even the idea that each traveler would be, or citizen would be assigned a kind of number, sort of like a credit rating for how for your risk factor?
It's actually more serious because when a similar proposal came out a few years ago, they referred to it as the terrorist threat index. It was a number from 0 to 1 that they were proposing to assign to passengers that basically was an assessment of the likelihood that a particular person posed a risk to aviation security. Now, I will say that the Department of Homeland Security does something similar when it's inspecting cargo containers that enter the United States. And I think that actually makes sense. They're trying to allocate resources and they're trying to figure out which containers do they need to look at more closely.
Fair enough for containers, but you can picture a situation here where if you've got a nice number, you're just sort of streaming right on. But if you don't, you're standing in some hellish long line. I mean, you have said that the TSA pre-check program could amount almost to extortion. Tell us everything, or you wait.
Well, that's, and you used that that comment earlier. I mean, it is a form of leverage that seems very unfair for the government to be able to exercise, basically to say to people, you know, unless you give us a lot more information, we won't let you go about your day as you were planning to. But I think the other problem here, of course, is that there's so little transparency about what the agency's doing. You immediately ask questions like, is the data accurate? Is it reliable? Is this program efficient? Do we agree with how the determinations are made? And without the ability to actually inspect how the program operates and to challenge the data collection, there could be many, many false positives. I mean, this was also a prior experience the TSA had when they were doing the CAPS II program. I think they pulled aside Senator Kennedy because he was, you know, mistakenly on a list.
Or I read about people who signed up for the Trusted Traveler program or applied for it. Then some, you know, ancient interaction from teenage years is found, and instead of having an easy way on, they've got this kind of a permanently harder way on and can't figure out why. Let's hear from our listeners. And Kip Hawley, I'll come to you. Jeff in Columbia, South Carolina. Jeff, you're on the air.
Hey, Tom.
Hi. What do you think?
I have a comment and then a question.
Yes, sir.
I'm in the military, so to me, privacy is a relative issue. I mean, we have to give up our DNA. I've had a background check for my secret clearance. And I don't like it when I go through the airports and I see a lieutenant colonel or a sergeant major that have to get patted down or go through the x-ray machine. Will there be some sort of program allowing the military folks that already have such clearances to go through without having to provide additional information or go through the process again?
Interesting question. Kip Hawley, what do you think? For people who have sort of given up everything, including their DNA, could they just have a special military walk-on instead of going through the line?
Well, we looked at giving a free pass with random, as Mark mentioned, random's got to be in everything, to anybody with a top secret or above clearance. And the problem at that point was getting the accurate current data to the checkpoint. So the CIA is obviously going to be reluctant to have TSA officers access to the database of who's who. And that was the problem there. But conceptually, that's a test of whether we trust someone is not. But again, as Major Hassan that example is, Al-Qaeda is very skilled at determining what our risk factors are, and then finding somebody who is exempt from them. So the short answer to the question is yes, it has been concerned. It has been considered, and it if they can figure out how to get the data to the checkpoint in a secure way, I expect that is probably the first step, or should be the first step.
Mark Rotenberg, with respect to the military and to our caller there, you know, great. On the other hand, I worry about getting backed into a situation where anybody who hasn't done that military style, tell us everything, show us everything, you know, we know you inside out, becomes a kind of second class or third class traveler. You know, what about American privacy? What about the ability just to travel around our own country and head overseas, telling the government maybe what they need to know, but not more, not so much?
Well, I think that's right, Tom. Travelers are reasonable about security. I think they understand, obviously, there's a need to ensure the safety of the plane. There's a need to identify threats. And I think where, you know, the government is acting responsibly, people don't object. But you do have the sense with the TSA that many of these programs, you know, the puffer machines, the airport body scanners, proposals now for, you know, profiling passengers seem to go just way over the line. And part of it, as I said, it's not just about privacy. It's about the ability to actually evaluate these techniques to be able to determine whether they actually make air travelers safer. We spent a lot of time looking at the airport body scanners. That was actually one of our cases against the TSA, and we figured out, and scientific experts agreed, that they weren't particularly effective in trying to detect the threats that had emerged post 9/11. So it wasn't just about privacy. It was also about whether this is a smart use of government resources. Mm. And I think with the profiling of passengers, when you're keeping people off of planes because they have, you know, trespass conviction, you know, minor drug offense, maybe arrest only. I mean, you have lots and lots of people who've been arrested with no disposition data. According to TSA, you don't get to qualify for global entry because of that. Even the criminal justice system wouldn't make such a harsh determination.
We're looking at new strategies for air travel security. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. But maybe people are happy to give up information to travel. Maybe they are. Andrea in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Andrea, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I am a big fan of the GOES program and the new TSA program. I travel
GOES, all that's the
time.
Global Entry Program. Is that what you mean, Andrea? This.
Yep.
Okay.
And I have to argue with you. You said earlier in the program about the fact that you were going to have to give up all your personal information to be able to apply for those programs. And that's absolutely not true. It's a really simple program. They do take your fingerprints, which I think is great. They ask you some questions. I actually talked a little bit about, you know, being a youngster and probably not doing some smart things at one point.
Was it a one-on-one interview, Andrea, or how did they do it? Okay.
Yeah, it's a one-on-one interview. You go into the airport and go into the offices, and they chat with you for about 15, 20 minutes. They take your fingerprints. They take your information.
And now you don't have to go through a security check typically at all? Is that the deal?
When I'm coming back into the country, I just have to use my passport and put it in a little machine, kiosk machine, and answer some quick questions and give them my fingerprints again, and then you whiz right through. And I have to tell you, I was coming back from a foreign country a few months ago, and my colleagues who didn't have the GOES program ended up missing their plane because the lines were so long.
Well, there you go. And it seems like a reasonable trade-off to you. I apologize, but our time is so short. Let me pick it up right there. Mark, there's a happy traveler. She's surrendered not so much information feels to her and made her flight. The others did not.
I've got bad news for Andrew. I mean, she may have a good experience now, but the people who signed up for the CLEAR program a few years back, very similar program, that company experienced bankruptcy, and one of the first things they did was to take the big database of biometric identifiers and put it up for auction. And it took the 180,000 travelers, frequent travelers, by the way, who had signed up for CLEAR, to block the disclosure, the sale of that personal information. So the people who may be having good experiences now with these programs should really look much more closely at the recent history. It is not a happy story.
Brave new world. Andrea's happy with it so far. Others may be as well. But Kip Hawley, where are we headed here? Is this the right direction? You said earlier you're not sure it's going to work.
Well, I think they should overhaul the entire system at this point and treat all passengers let all passengers have access to the smoother screening. And that means pulling out the old security measures that no longer are needed, which include the blades. And frankly, the liquid restrictions should be pulled back now because they can, in fact, differentiate threat liquid.
So you're saying no metal detector, no security line at all?
No. Okay. I'm saying sharply reduce it. But rather than trying to pick out the special few who you think you've got an algorithm is going to predict that they're better, is why not just make it to all people and make the whole system smoother? You put in some random, and you can certainly experiment with some of the top secret or whatever, but I think we've got the wrong approach here, which is to cling like I don't know what to every security measure we put in.
Right.
We should view them all.
Let some
as
go.
Because Al Qaeda is changing by the day and month, and we need to be that fast.
Changing too. Mark Rotenberg, that doesn't sound like where we're headed. Sounds like where we're headed is to much more data collection and what, discrimination between travelers?
Oh, I don't think so, Tom. I think Congress is going to take a close look at this. I think TSA is going to back off. I mean, this is an agency that comes up with ideas that people don't like.
Well,
and I think we're going to be hearing more about it.
It looks like the plan right now. We'll see where it goes. Mark Rotenberg with the Electronic Privacy Information Center. Thank you very much for being with us, Mark.
Thank you, Tom.
And Kip Hawley, former head of the TSA. Thank you, Mr. Hawley.
Thank you, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.